Hi there, my name is Roy Mowat and I'm the founder of Lifebook. Lifebook is the experience of sharing your stories in an autobiography for your family, and I'm delighted to introduce the companion to that autobiography, the Audio Highlights Recording. Once the autobiography is complete, we invite our authors to read out some of their favourite stories or chapters from their Lifebook. Lifebook has been a very personal journey for me, beginning with interviewing my father for his memoirs, so as I never forgot his amazing stories. This became a wonderful project for my father, unearthing numerous stories I'd never even heard before, and has become a treasured gift for the whole family. I just wish I had a recording of him reading some of those stories. This is why I'm excited we created Lifebook Audio Highlights, and you will be able to enjoy this recording for generations to come.
This is Alan Dock. Most of you read this are my sons and daughters, grandsons, and maybe grandkids and great-grandkids. Today's date is 15th of June, 2024. I'm going to read you some of my favourite stories from my book, Grabbing Life by the Throat, My Pursuit of Learning. The dedication of this book, the account of my life, incomplete as it is dedicated to all members of my much-loved extensive family. It's an attempt to provide answers to the questions that have arisen over 60 years in conversation with some of you. I also mark at this point the dedicated professional help I've received from Julie, my interlocutor, an extractor of memories long forgotten, and Bailey, my indefatigable scribe and ghostwriter. As I approach the end of the project, I have hope that some of the younger members of the family would take up the challenge and continue to record the unfolding lives of the Dock clan, thus providing a history for as yet unborn generations of this diverse and restive family. The Prelude. Thing is, this is my life, and it's emotional, very emotional, to read through it, I'll be honest. But I haven't been able to treat this project objectively. It's quite a complex task to piece together your entire life and present it in a coherent, sequential story. I hope I've done all right by the task and keep it somewhat humorous. I'm 85 years old, and I recently experienced radiation every day over 7 weeks at Johns Hopkins in Rockville, Maryland. While ill health certainly crystallizes one's thinking, the reason I feel compelled to write this memoir is tied to my children and grandchildren. They are unaware of many details in my narrative and have often inquired about my past, wanting to know what I've done and where I've been. I began recounting my life to some of them when casually gathered around the fire one night. We recorded some conversation together. But now I believe it's time to give my story some structure. There is much my children don't know of my life, and while they have been told of some of its parts, they are missing the whole. So here it is. You may not know, but occasionally in moments of angst, I write poetry. This was one such an attempt. A major change of direction in my life occurred when Shirley and I divorced. This part was written when I was in the throes of indecision during a mission to Malawi. A Long Night in Malawi, written in November 1989. Do you feel close to me when the breeze sighs softly at the end of day? Do you hear my whispered responses to your hidden thoughts? Do you sense me near you when the night is long and the hour at the lowest ebb? Do you hear my laugh in yours as we're still sharing like life's random quirks? Do you feel my hurt when you hurt? Do you feel my love when I remember yours? For I feel you here where you've not been. I know you're near when you're not. I often yearn to turn back the clock while crying caution. That way lies hurt for both. This I know. In June will come a time, time for love and autumn gold, time for endure adventures and trusted sharing, or time for parting, time for ruling off, not with hate, but with love of what was and never again can be. In this time for reflection on past and possible futures, on should it be yes, oh yes, or should it be no, alas, no, that I think of you oft in sadness, oft in longing, sometimes in relief, sometimes in anger, most oft in that unstable amalgam we made of marriage over 26 joyous, glooming, patchwork years, but always, always with love. The story is from Chapter 11, Moving On. Following Rhodesia's independence in 1980, local property became immensely appealing to the numerous aid agencies and embassies that suddenly arrived in the new Zimbabwe. During Ian Smith's tenure, his so-called UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence regime, with its white-only government backed only by South Africa, had enjoyed very limited international support. This discouraged investment and depressed the property prices. The post-independence period was marked by an influx of people and the demand for houses inevitably surged, propelling property values upwards. The semi-rural Jizapiti house and 3 acres that I had purchased for £4,000 when we came back from the Bahamas became highly attractive to agencies who wanted to set up a base. They sought reasonably sized houses where they could potentially expand or build additional structures on the land. Eventually, we sold our house and land to an incoming embassy for a substantial profit. With the proceeds from the sale, we scanned the area for potential investments. At that time, rural areas hadn't surged in value as swiftly as semi-rural areas, since they weren't much interested in buying bought farms. There was simply no significant demand for them. Consequently, we had the finances from the sale of the Chizapiti home to acquire an existing farm situated in Mazoe, just outside Harare, marking the start of a more authentic farming endeavour for us. The property we purchased had a complex history. It bore the scars of its past in the form of several substantial holes, remnants of previous gold mining activities that had taken place in the region. Although the area indicated traces of gold, we didn't discover any substantial deposits. Our new farm encompasses around 300 acres, approximately 50 of which were suitable for cultivation, while the rest considered rocky terrain and the remnants of previously mined ventures. Water supply emerged as a critical concern. To address this, we installed pumps on 2 boreholes, ensuring a steady and reliable water source. Once we began operations, we built on our Chizapiti experience and our focus shifted towards cultivating vegetables, for which purpose we utilized approximately 2 acres. We attended local markets on a weekly and monthly basis to sell our produce. We also grew modest crops of corn and sorghum, borrowing equipment from neighbours to reap the crops and then selling them to the grain marketing board. One year I produced 11 tons of corn, which I thought was quite a lot of corn. Despite our best efforts, the farm wasn't financially profitable, but it did bring us joy and satisfaction. I particularly relished spending my weekends on the tractor ploughing the land. Given the subpar quality of the land, it wasn't conducive for running extensive cattle farming operations, but it was suitable for Dexter cattle. This small breed of cattle originated in the southwest of Ireland and was adopted in the 19th century for milk and fresh meat on sailing ships. Dexter was also ideal for areas with limited grazing, as they required less food. Eventually, we managed it. A herd of around 80 miniature Dexter cows. We had one bull only. Bushman was his name. Additionally, we kept goats for milk along with the cows, as well as a mix of chickens, ducks, and various other animals on the farm. As our children grew older and began assisting us more, we were able to expand the farming operations. Within the 300 acres of our property, there was a village where 20 to 30 individuals resided. We hired 5 or 6 of these locals on a regular basis to help manage various farm tasks, tending to the vegetables, looking after the cattle, and taking care of the routine chores. It was more than just employment. These individuals were not only self-sufficient, but also contributed to the farm's functionality. They lived on the land itself, eliminating the need for commuting, and supplemented their livelihood by maintaining their own chickens and similar endeavors. It was a mutually beneficial arrangement that worked out quite well for everyone involved. On Sunday mornings, we took walks around the farm, exploring the entire area, which often took a couple of hours to cover. I remember venturing into the mines once or twice out of curiosity of what lay within. They were essentially just holes with horizontal tunnels reaching about 30 feet into the ground. We eventually fenced them off, concerned about the possibility of children trying to access them. As part of the divorce settlement, I passed ownership of the farm over to Shirley. She intended to continue living there, and since it was only some 20 miles outside Harare, she developed a plan to build small cottages to rent to people who were looking for a peaceful and rural break from the pace of town life. Several cottages were built, and the scheme showed signs of becoming a useful part of her income. My daughter Eleanor moved on to the farm from Harare with her 3 children and helped Shirley develop her plan to expand the produce production to include the growth of peppers and other vegetables. She'd been on track to becoming a lawyer, and her achievements were so outstanding that with aspirations of studying at Oxford, she even contemplated applying for a Rhodes Scholarship. Her plans took a different turn, however, when her boyfriend, Mark, entered the picture. They got married quickly on our farm, rented a house in Borrowdale, began a family together. As the Zimbabwe education system deteriorated, however, aided by the decision to abandon internationally recognized school examinations such as A-levels, which had been inherited from the British system and were deemed colonial remnants, Eleanor sought better education opportunities for her children elsewhere. She made the decision to relocate to Britain, and accompanied by Mark, he and her children started a new life there. Mark had aspirations of furthering his education in Britain, so Eleanor took on the responsibility of working to support the family while he pursued his studies. He had never, though, fared well as a father or a husband, and upon completing his master's degree, he disappeared from the scene. In 2002, Mugabe's government passed legislation through Parliament which permitted forced takeover of white-owned farms without compensation. Furthermore, black Zimbabweans who had established communities on the farm and frequently worked on them were also expelled during the takeover. Soon after the Land Acquisition Act was enacted, Shirley received a letter informing her that she no longer owned the farm. She was given a month to vacate, leaving behind all farm equipment without compensation for land, houses, or equipment. Small farms such as this one ended up being owned by favored members of Mugabe's government, of course. She too left Zimbabwe soon after that and joined our son Barry and his family in Herne Bay on the Cape Coast. The British government provided a small pension and assisted her in finding a small apartment. The reason for this, I believe, was that during my graduate training in Britain, Shirley was employed, paying taxes and contributing to the British system. Shirley soon established herself in the community of Herne Bay, babysitting her grandchildren in Barry's family and becoming a leading light in community group activities. We maintained a fair amount of contact during the years. When Mary came into the picture, she and Shirley sometimes met at family function. And while this was a bit awkward at first, I think they grew to like each other. Shirley used to fly to the States to visit Gavin in Virginia. We always ate lunch or dinner when we were all together. Once she even came to my house for Christmas. Sadly, Shirley is gone now. She passed away in late 2023 from an aggressive form of leukemia, surrounded by her four children and their families. I would have wished to be there myself, but Shirley intimated that she didn't want my presence during her passing, and I respected her wishes. I wrote a difficult letter to her, which I hope repaired some of the injury I had done to her and our family. Stories from Chapter 12, Closure and New Beginnings. This really is a strange story. While living in Harare, I took a friend who was visiting from Britain to a tourist village in town where you could see the traditional Tshona people living. Within the village was a witch doctor who captivated my friend with his vibrant feathers and intriguing demeanor. After a brief spectacle, the witch doctor turned his attention to me, fixing me with an intense gaze. "I need to talk to you," he offered in solemn tones. Although he had never encountered each other before, he proceeded to unfold a startling revelation. "Your parents are very angry with you," he declared. "They're buried in Zambia and you haven't visited their graves in many years." This sent a chill down my spine. These were facts I couldn't deny. I hadn't returned to Zambia for many years. He detailed the steps I should take to rectify the situation. First and foremost, a journey to Zambia was imperative. There, at the graveside, I was to pay my respects and execute various rituals, including the pouring of beer on the grounds. Despite his detailed instructions, I gave no thought to them for quite some time. However, one Saturday morning in Zambia, Mary and I drove out to the Kabalonga Cemetery where my parents were buried. The area of the cemetery that I remember as the site of my parents' grave had become heavily overgrown in the 20 or so years that had passed, and I had trouble finding them. Towering over the bush scrub and small trees, however, I could see a magnificent bougainvillea tree, which I then remembered had been planted on my mother's grave soon after her burial by her close friend May Rogers, by now also long gone. Mary and I stood at the graves and followed the advice which the witch doctor in Harare several years previously had made. I introduced Mary as my wife-to-be, and we solemnly poured some beer on each grave before drinking the remainder herself. I felt a lightening in my step after that small event, strange but true. Stories from Chapter 15, Grab Life by the Throat. In 2011, I faced a challenging chapter in my life when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. To address the condition, I underwent surgery. This involved a robotic operation to remove the cancerous prostate. Unfortunately, the procedure resulted in significant damage to my urinary system, leaving me incontinent upon waking up. Coping with this newfound reality was incredibly tough, and for 2 years, I relied on nappies and other aids to manage the situation. I even tried clamps. I leave you to imagine what those are for. While I had tried everything within reach, the system ultimately came from another oncologist who recommended an artificial sphincter implant. This device, situated around the urethra, granted the control of my urinary function through a push button located in my scrotum. A significant improvement that has brought a measure of normality back to my life. The artificial sphincter I had implanted wore out after about 4 years, necessitating another procedure to replace it. As I approach the end of the replacement's expected lifetime, I am reminded that these devices typically last 4 to 5 years. Despite the need for periodic replacement, it remains the most civilized solution available for me. With the implant in place, I no longer experience leakage or the need for these damn nappies. It allows me to function without worry or inconvenience. When I'm traveling, attending to daily activities, or even flying on an aircraft, it provides reliable control over my urinary functions. It's a solution that has greatly improved the quality of my life. It was around the time of the replacement that the COVID-19 pandemic began. I contracted COVID early on, but fortunately I took Paxil, and that took care of it. No hospitalization was needed. It gave me a metallic taste in my mouth, and I had some side effects, but nothing I couldn't cope with. Since then, I've kept up with the shots religiously. Looking back, the isolation was overestimated by most people because of the hype that surrounded it. We were very cautious back then, getting groceries delivered instead of going to the supermarket, and the couriers dropped everything outside our garage, and then I had a table where everything that came in was sprayed. I was quite meticulous. Now I go to the supermarket, and if it's crowded, I wear a mask. It's not a big deal. After my initial battle with prostate cancer, I faced another setback when my PSA levels began to rise again. PSA, or prostate specific antigen, is a crucial marker used to monitor prostate activity. Concerned by the upward trend in my PSA, I sought the expertise of a new oncologist who conducted thorough tests, including MRI scans. The diagnosis revealed a disheartening reality. Remnants of prostate tissue had been left behind during the initial surgery, allowing the cancer to grow slowly over the years. Faced with a recurrence, my oncologist presented radiation therapy as a potential solution to eradicate the remaining cancer cells. After careful consideration, I opted for the radiation treatment, which commenced toward the end of 2023. While the treatment process itself was not overburdensome, requiring me to rely on a machine delivering targeted radiation, ensuring my internal organs were in the right position proved challenging. Additionally, adhering to the treatment protocol involved arriving with a full bladder and an empty colon, a seemingly incompatible routine that underscored the unique nature of medical procedures. I did radiation therapy a total of 35 times, 5 times a week for 7 weeks. As I completed my radiation treatment, there was nearly a celebration from the medical staff, marked by a certificate and the tradition of ringing the bell at the radiation center's entrance. While these gestures were meant to signify the end of treatment, they didn't make me feel any better. At the end of March of 2024, I had a crucial PSA test to gauge the effectiveness of the radiation. Ideally, I hoped for a PSA reading of 0 or close to it, indicating successful treatment. In fact, I had a reading of 0.2, which is indicative of much reduced cancer activity. My oncologist has mentioned alternative options such as chemotherapy or hormone therapy, but neither holds much appeal. Having witnessed the extraordinary effect of chemotherapy, I'm hesitant to subject myself to such harsh treatment. Similarly, the prospect of hormone therapy with potential side effects such as breast cancer doesn't suit me well either. These decisions weigh heavily on my mind as I navigate the complexities of cancer treatment and try to maintain quality of life. While I may change my mind upon seeing the oncologist, I've decided that if the PSA results indicate signs of progression, let it grow. It's slow growing. So if it takes 10 years, it takes 10 years. It will run its course. Cancer has a way of reminding you of your vulnerability. You start thinking, is this the end of my life? Am I going out with this disease? The experience prompts introspection about the finite nature of life and the looming question of how much time truly remains. These thoughts often lead to moments of reflection with my children. We've had candid conversations about life, illness, and the inevitability of mortality. It was during one of these discussions, more an interrogation really, recorded by my children, that the concept of documenting my journey took root. It was the germ of an idea back then, but their genuine interest and concern sparked the realization that sharing my experience could offer something beneficial. These recordings never amounted to anything, and neither did a further attempt at recording stories by my son Gavin. So that's why I thought, let me get a professional to do this. If I'm paying a lot of money, I have to get it finished. Other than this fight with cancer, my life hasn't changed so much except that I'm getting older. I can't ignore the stiffness creeping into my feet and legs. I'm creaky, I get irritable sometimes. I always apologize to Mary afterwards. Then Mary gets irritable with me sometimes because I can't walk as fast as she can and I can't go out as much as she can. I don't want to eat the range of things that she wants to eat. She's quite the active one, always on the tennis court or cycling 20 or 30 miles without breaking a sweat. Her dedication to staying healthy is admirable, and I believe it's paying off for her. She had a brush with breast cancer a while back before my own nightmare started, but thankfully it was caught in the early stages and she managed to overcome it. Generally, she is sensitive to my reduced mobility, but also spurs me on to make journeys to new places. She's a wonderful partner. I'm astonished at my good fortune. I'm thinking about taking on running so I can keep up with her again. My heart's strong and I feel that then. Leg muscles need extra work. But I refuse to get on a peloton where you immediately enslaved by whatever is coming over the video screen. I have one false knee that gives me no trouble whatsoever, but the other one is seriously damaged. Climbing stairs becomes a tedious task with one leg dragging the other due to the strain. I contemplated getting it fixed, but the post-operation therapy for knee surgery is dauntingly painful and lengthy. My orthopedic surgeon did a commendable job on my first knee, occasionally assesses the second. He suggested a treatment I dubbed Jiffy Lube for the lubricating properties. It involves injecting a lubricant under the kneecap, providing relief for a few months. The injection does alleviate some discomfort, although it doesn't strengthen the muscles. Still, it's covered by medical aid, so I plan to undergo the procedure again. However, my surgeon has reservations about operating on my other knee, citing my age as a concern. As much as I'd like to defy the odds, I can't help but agree with his assessment when I think about the very painful rehabilitation process. I also do a weight regime twice a week with a friend, Mike Stewart, designed to improve my strength and balance. And it seems to work. Despite my age, travelling is always on my mind. New Zealand and Australia are still on my bucket list. I recently caught up with a friend who just returned from a 5-week adventure down under with his family. He mentioned it was a bit pricey, but totally worth it. According to him, the scenery in New Zealand is nothing short of spectacular. He mentioned the flight was quite the journey, 27 hours non-stop from here to Auckland. As for Australia, he likened it to the US in many ways. Australia does seem to have its own unique charm, even if it might be a bit rugged in places. Like any vast country, it probably varies greatly depending on where you visit. When I was younger, my ideal way of doing the trip to Australia would have been to take a ship that pulls out of India and goes down the coast to Australia. Then maybe you hop across to New Zealand. It would take about 3 months. Do properly. I'm not sure this vision of mine will happen to me at this point, but we're going to Norway this year, 2024. We fly to Britain in July and leave for Southampton on a boat that takes us down the fjords for about a week. Mary's not very keen on spending a long time in a big cruise boat. She did a lot of sailing before I came along and much prefers that style of a smaller boat. These days, I keep myself occupied with reading. Scientific American, New Scientist, and New Science News are three magazines that I subscribe to, keeping me up to date with everything happening in the science world, which has been my interest all my life. I also have an extensive workshop downstairs, although I don't use it much these days. In fact, one of the tasks on my list is to go down and clean it up. The last major project I undertook down there was about 2 years ago. A good friend had a grandfather clock that fell over, and well, got knocked over, and it ended up shattering it into all sorts of pieces. It came to me in two buckets, a puzzle of sorts. I spent about 5 months meticulously putting it back together. It was like solving a jigsaw puzzle. I didn't intend to restore the mechanical workings, that was beyond my expertise. Instead, I replaced the heart with a little electric one, similar to what I did with our own block downstairs. It was a laborious process, but incredibly satisfying in the end. As I've gotten older, I've noticed that I need a midday nap more often. Sometimes midday arrives as early as 11 o'clock in the morning. I find myself dozing off for about half an hour. One of my favourite things to do during this time is to put the laundry in the machine and sit and rest while it cycles through before transferring it to the dryer and starting a new load. It's a brief break, but it works wonders for me. I also enjoy going for walks with Lady and Mary, usually twice a week when the weather is nice. However, I can't stand cold weather. It makes my skin itchy and puts me in a grumpy mood. At time of writing, her winter has spurned its spring and I can feel the difference in the weather and in my need. I'm hoping that the warmer days will bring back the mobility I've missed, but I'll just have to wait and see. My doctor has reassured me multiple times that all things considered, I'm in good health for my age. Thankfully, I haven't experienced any cognitive decline or issues with mental processing. So for now, I'm thankful that everything seems to be functioning well. My motto is, grab life by the throat. I really hope I've done that well. I certainly consider myself incredibly fortunate. I've had the opportunity to live two distinct lives. I've been married twice, with each marriage bringing its own joys and experiences. I've had two sets of children who bring me joy, and I've found fulfillment in both phases of my life. This may be the end of the so-called life project, but I'm looking forward to experiencing and writing further chapters. I thought I'd finish by reading one of the last poems I wrote, because I only wrote them when I'm feeling full of angst. But anyway, this one was when I was contemplating the end of life, and it's called A Reverie. Look for me not in the moneyed malls of America, in the rolling void of middle canvas, in the turbulent maelstrom of the Washington Beltway. Look for me not in the quiet green lands of England, in the serried ranks of suburban castles and in the brash cheerfulness of the English summer. Seek me in the dark, beer-scented brown of the local pub, in the surprising sighs of Eleuthera Casuarina pines, in the thunderous surf and reflective sounds of America's coastline. Find me in Africa, in the soaring cries of the fish eagle, in the dusty tension of the approaching storm, in the surfeit of that first rains, in the pensive copies of the Matopas, in the broad deep reaches of Zambezi floods, and in the smoky, timeless villages of Africa. There you will find my spirit, free, happy, and at rest. Here end my audio highlights. I hope you've enjoyed listening to them.